Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted to welcome a very accomplished professional from Minneapolis, USA, Kim Witsak. Kim, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Kim is an international drug safety advocate and speaker. She was instrumental in helping to get the FDA black box suicide warnings added to antidepressants in 2004 and 2006. Kim is currently a consumer representative on the FDA Psychopharmacologic Drug Advisory Committee. And given the kind of work that she has been doing, she's been recognized and felicitated several times. So Kim, before we talk drug safety, tell me about your own journey in brief and what motivated you to become an international drug safety advocate?
Sure. Well, I like to call myself the accidental advocate because I would never have chosen this work. Mm-hmm. However, sometimes our greatest purposes choose us. And, you know, by background, I'm a professional advertising and marketing executive. Okay. And I was in 2003, I was happily married to my husband of almost 10 years. We both had successful careers. We both traveled the world. We were just starting to talk about having a family. And my husband had just started his dream job with a startup company and started having trouble sleeping, which is not uncommon for entrepreneurs, as mm-hmm. you know. So he went to his doctor, his family doctor, the doctor that always fixed him up. You know, he was an athlete, and told him he wasn't able to sleep. And the doctor gave him a prescription, or actually samples to start out with, to 3-week sample pack of Zoloft, and told him it would take the edge off and help him sleep. I was out of the country the first 3 weeks he was on the drug. I was down in New Zealand on a shoot. It was my busy time of year. And when I came back, I'll never forget. So here I'm thinking Woods on his, you know, on his journey, whatever he's doing. I come back and I'll never forget. I walk in the back door. Woody came through in his blue dress shirt, completely sweat through his shirt, dropped his bag at the back door, and fell down in a fetal position. Kim, you got to help me. My head's outside my body looking in, and he's rocking back and forth. And I'm like, oh, I've never seen that kind of behavior from him or anything. Calmed him down. He called the doctor, and the doctor said to give it 4 to 6 weeks to kick in. I happened to be out of town the next week again. And I called my dad because I hadn't heard from Woody. I'm like, Dad, do me a favor. Go check our house. I don't know, like, if Woody has been having trouble sleeping. Maybe he hit his head. My dad went over there and called me. And I'll never forget that phone call. He's like, it's bad. It's bad. And I'm like, what do you mean it's bad? And he's like, Woody's dead. And I'm like, what? He's like, Woody's dead. I'm like, what do you mean Woody's dead? And he's like, how do you know he's dead? And he goes, he's hanging. I'm like, hanging? Like, it literally, in one phone call, my entire life changed. And I will tell you that intuitively, every part of me was like, this doesn't even make sense. This guy loved life. He just started his dream job. Like, we just booked our 10-year anniversary trip. Like, literally, it made no sense. And that night that I was in Detroit, out of town, the coroner asked one question, and she asked, was he on any medication? And mm-hmm. the only drug Woody was taking was Zoloft. And she going to take it with us. It might have something to do with his death. And ironically, on the front page of our Minneapolis Star Tribune, there was an article that said the UK finds link between antidepressants and suicide in teens. Mm. And so literally, Woody left no note. That became like our note. And everything intuitively inside me was like, something doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we never once, because Woody didn't have a history of depression. He didn't get it for depression, you know, and we never once questioned the drug at the time, because why would we? It was FDA approved, mm-hmm. handed to him by his doctor, and was sold and advertised as safe and effective. So that really became my mission. And we call it the Battle of Woody. And that became kind of what led to eventually my drug safety work and why I'm an accidental advocate all these years later, 2 decades later. So.
Well, my condolences. I mean, Woody seemed like a very, very interesting person, and I'm sorry for your loss.
Thanks.
Kim, given the amount of work that you have done in the area of drug safety after your own experience, what, in your view, are some of the most significant flaws in the current drug safety system?
Sure. Well, I would say number one, we have the pharmaceutical marketing. I mean, we're one of only two countries in the world that allows direct to consumer advertising. So I think that's an issue. I think that all the, I call it the, I've now cons created something called the spider web, and it's all the marketing influences on almost every aspect, like regulatory capture, like the FDA, Congress, lobbying, who's behind it. And then realizing that at the FDA, the same people that approve the drugs are the same people that are responsible for removing the drugs from market or even looking into safety. So to me, there's a lot of conflicts of interest and lack of transparency.
Very well said. And I've spent 14, 15 years in pharmacies, and I've often debated, I've written about this, that, and you are a marketing person, this is the only industry where the brand owner does not treat you and me, who are the brand consumer, as their customer, but for them, the customer is the doctor.
Right. It is very interesting. And that's in my spider web that I have created, I put both the doctor and the consumer in there because I think, ultimately there are a lot of techniques that the companies use that doctors are not even aware of. Like, the who owns the who, ghostwriting? Who's writing the articles that appear in the medical journals that our doctors are reading? Key opinion leaders, which basically are these doctors that, are paid by pharma. That's an entire industry to go out and find the key opinion leaders that actually help to drive the narrative. And, and a lot of the screening tools that are used at the doctor's offices are actually created by pharmaceutical companies, like the depression screening form was created by a Pfizer marketing guy in the 90s. So it's really about marketing that our doctors don't know. And then one of the other things I have to say that I was shocked about is that doctor, who controls the medical education in and I'm talking in America specifically, but if the pharmaceutical companies, with all the monies they give to academic institutions, if that's creating the narrative or the education, the platform, how are our doctors going to learn some of these, I call them the critical thinking skills? I mean, we trust our doctor, and I think the doctor trusts that the FDA. So the whole system's kind of built in
I
trust.
agree. I completely agree with you. But moving on, what are some of the common misconceptions about drug safety that you have encountered as someone who has been battling this whole challenge?
Sure. I think one of the biggest battles, I think, is this the consumer perspective and doctors safe and effective. Like this idea of safe and effective. You assume that the drug that you're being prescribed is going to help, not harm. And so understanding, like, even how things are coming to the FDA, I sit on the FDA committee now and I see how drugs are being fast-tracked and using these mechanisms that Congress put in play that allow drugs to get on the market faster. And I think, I think there's a culture of we never think anything's going to happen to us, right? Oh yeah, those warnings. But until it does happen to you and then you actually go in and dig deep, you find out things are very different than what you were led to believe.
Great response. Thank you. My next question is that what strategies do you believe are most effective in holding pharmaceutical companies accountable for drug safety?
Well, I would say I have one that I believe that we need litigation. I think the power of lawsuits, because I did have a lawsuit against Pfizer, and we were able to get in And I think why lawsuits are important is that you're able to go in and do discovery, because the government can't get into company files. The CDC, the FDA, nobody can. And so Congress can't. So the only way to really hold is to be able to do discovery. And I think that is one aspect. I think it's an important mechanism. I think transparency and having the ability to, and disclosure and letting, I think that is really important, is to know where, if somebody has financial or implied or intellectual biases. There's a lot of those. I think, the idea of whistleblower protection. I think we need to, people who are brave enough to come forward, we need to give them protections, because that's also an area. Consumer advocacy, organizations and grassroots, people like myself that actually stand up when, and it shouldn't take something bad to go wrong to want to do the right thing. And, ultimately, I think it's about corporate responsibility. I think, companies have the ability to do the hard right, not the easy wrong, and put profits before patients.
Well said, well said. And how do you navigate, and when I say you, how does one navigate conflicts of interest within drug safety and regulation?
Yeah, it's interesting, because I think we all have a perspective. I mean, I personally got removed. It was interesting. I got removed from my FDA advisory board because I had an intellectual bias. I didn't even know what that meant. And it basically was saying that I put safety, safety, and I knew something about this drug and Pfizer, and I wanted to know about the lawsuits and all of this. And I got removed. But in, sitting next to me is somebody who has their own biases. Even on the advisory committee members, there's something called self-censorship. If you know that your finances or your career or your next move is somehow tied to the industry in which you are regulating, I think we have to be really important. I have to go through all kinds of conflicts of training before even, and I think the FDA, like, there's so many things of the revolving doors. That's a conflict of interest between industry to the FDA and back. And so I think we should always ask in where is this person's point of view coming? And then also, where's the financial? Obviously, I always say safety is my priority. I will always come from that perspective. And if you don't want me, then just know that that's where I'm going to come from, because I know that there are real world consequences. Now, I don't have a, that's my only stake. My life doesn't depend on it, meaning my financial to pay for, living expenses. And so I think, all of those are factors in navigating conflicts of interest.
Great response. Thank you. The other question I have, Kim, is that what role do you see for digital media in enhancing drug safety awareness?
Oh, well, it's funny, because that is my industry, being in. I know that there's a lot of power in digital marketing and using the tools that are out there. One thing I would say that, because you can, like, real world responses, right? Especially when I see that clinical trials are used by, are really on a small number, especially the ones that are coming through. It, once marketing hits, and the advertising is out either to doctors, consumers, the real world is really where we need to be worrying about, and what's it look like. And also, digital media is an opportunity to hear what the people are saying, right? And be more proactive. Now, my only concern is, as we saw with some of the COVID with vaccine injuries, if who's controlling it. And so I think that is something that I am concerned about. But I do think that digital media has a huge opportunity to play with real world, and to be able to also help disseminate potential safety issues, or even to let people know that the regulators are looking at it. Not saying it's causation, but we're looking at this. So I think there is a potential for it, for sure.
Well said. So, when I was reading about you to prepare for my conversation, You've been involved with international conferences like Selling Sickness, People Before Profits. What are some insights that you have gained from your involvement in such conferences?
Sure. So one of the ways, when your husband kills himself and it doesn't make sense, you go out and want to learn everything. It becomes like an investigation, right? And so I luckily love to travel internationally, and I would go to all these conferences, like Disease Mongering was a conference, Selling Sickness. It was put on by the Dutch government in Amsterdam in 2010. And almost every example that they used were strategies that pharma uses. It was called Selling Sickness, right? And how do you sell to healthy people or the worried well? And almost every example that they were giving was from the United States, but there was only a handful of us from the United States. And I was like, why isn't this conversation happening in the US? And so ultimately I asked the organizers if they were going to bring it to the US, and they said no. And so I don't know how I ended up being the one that, well, I'm like, if they're not bringing it, I got to bring it to the US. And so one of the things that I saw from that is really how much we can learn. You know, other countries have a different kind of model around pharmaceutical, right? And this idea of selling and like taking drugs for everything out there. And so we brought it here, and it was a collaboration, because one of the things in my role in advertising is I'm kind of a producer in the middle. So I bring people together, and we all have a role in the problem, and we all have a role in the solution, right? Mm-hmm. And so we brought in lawyers, because they get a different sense, right? Mm-hmm. The journalists, doctors, consumers, and as well as healthcare providers and academic. Mm-hmm. And so we developed the conference to have all those voices as a part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things I've noticed, and especially being just a lay, and I say lay person, because I'd go to these conferences and it was all these people talking at you, but I'm like, and they would see that I don't have any letters behind my name, like a PhD, JD, I call it the alphabet soup. And so they would just kind of dismiss. And I'm like, wait a minute, I have ideas too. And I think ideas come from all roles and different places, and not just the experts at the front of the room or the guy in the, or woman in the white coat.
Very well said. My next question is that, how do you engage with policymakers to advocate for safer drugs or drug policies?
Well, that was one of our original strategies right from the beginning, is we, because there, I didn't realize how involved Congress and our lobby, Congress and even like the FDA have in setting policies. And so it became our thing, like, let's get out, let's go talk to the people who are responsible. And actually, I think it's a balance between, stories and information and data, and really partnering together and showing what the problem is. But also, it's not about just problems, you bring solutions. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to bring ideas forward. Mm-hmm. So that they can, because they're basically, what I realize is we've got a lot of young people who are really the people who are, you got the senators and congressional, but it's the young people that really don't know everything about this issue. So mm-hmm. you have to bring ideas forward. And so that was one of the things that we did. As well as, push back. I mean, there are some things that I saw that in Congress, like advertising, that used to not be legal in our country. PDUFA, which is Prescription Drug User Fee Act, which allows the drug company, or basically the FDA, to collect user fees to review drug company applications, was a result of a legislation policy. And so we need to go in there and educate ourselves and push back and demand. And also, it's about working together and finding people in other organizations that may or may not agree on every issue, but finding common ground to help push our legislators.
Well said. I've got time for two or three more questions. You were also involved in pushing for FDA black box suicide warnings on antidepressants. Tell me a little bit about this, and what were some key challenges? Because The pharmaceutical industry has got a very, very powerful lobby, not just in the US, but in every country in the world.
Well, let me tell you, that was definitely, I walked into the lion's den, I noticed, because, you know, with antidepressants, well, first of all, when I look back and Googled Zoloft and suicide, the FDA held hearings in 1991 when it was only Prozac on the market and the emergence of violence and suicide, right? So I'm like, wait a minute, you guys knew about this issue and didn't follow up and you didn't demand that this was, and then you approved more drugs and for kids. So I think the pushing, you know, my husband's dead. It doesn't do me any good. But, you know, if I can save somebody else, I will do that, right? But, you know, it was very interesting that I saw that there, it was very polarizing because you had one side that was like, these drugs saved my life. And then you had the other side saying, these killed our loved ones, our kids. And so I realized that it's not an either or, it's a both and both and can live together. And also, you know, it's funny, I saw that a lot of times the victim gets blamed. Oh, well, of course they killed themselves. They're on an antidepressant. Well, the problem is these people and a lot of the people that showed up because they were in-person hearings, they weren't depressed. They didn't get it for depression. So I think when you start combining that and then also realizing that there was information that was coming out of other countries and other people that didn't have this, or, you know, that wanted to challenge the FDA. So I think really that, and then also, I think a big part of this was getting my documents out from under seal in my lawsuit and showed and used them everywhere from the FDA and Congress to really push for investigations and put pressure on the FDA because their names were all over these documents as well.
Well said. So time for two more questions. My next question is, what advice would you give to individuals who have experienced adverse drug effects?
Well, first, I would say, don't be afraid, you know, well, first, make sure you're safe. And if you're having any kind of, you know, impact, make sure you take care of yourself. But, and report to your doctor, the FDA, and don't also, like, don't allow your doctors or health systems or regulators to tell you that it's anecdotal or try to ghost you because it is really important to tell your story. Right now, they say that about four, it's one of the deaths by properly prescribed prescriptions is like the fourth leading cause. And sometimes I've heard third leading cause of death. And so that really tells you that it's a, it is a big issue. And it's about, you know, I think the problem with a lot of individuals happening, like if a plane goes down, you know, of course, everybody is all over it, right? But when individual harms usually happen one at a time, and in isolation or in silos. And so until you connect it and realize, whoa, it's a way bigger issue, I think that is why you should always be able to tell your story. And then I would say for future, always do your research and really kind of question, do I need this drug? Do I, if I am, like, what's the data? What are some of these, like, you know, when we were talking about conflicts of interest, where's all that coming from? But these are things that I think are ways to help keep you safe, but also be engaged and not run away because there are people who are out there fighting and not until something happens to you do you realize that it is a really big issue. So
well said. Kim, we've run out of time. So I just want to say thank you so much for speaking to me about your own amazing experience with and the story you told me about Woody. I mean, it has shaken me up quite a bit. I have been associated with the pharmacy business, and I know that this is not a challenge that is being faced just in America, but in every country in the world. Thank you for talking to me about so many different aspects of drug safety. Thank you for talking to me about what are some of the options that people can consider in the event they are faced with a similar or a different situation which has been caused because of poor drug regulation or badly manufactured drugs. Thank you again for speaking to me, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the brand called You Videocast and Podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.